So what was your experience with that?
First phase, that was the agreement in the topic, or disagreeing in the body, was totally stupefying to me because it held back. Uh-huh. It really felt bad to, I cannot do that. So I was thrown off the track all the time. I couldn't focus on the conversation because I had to do weird things. The other thing we chose, a political topic. We were not in, but still did find something really hot. But through the body language, I felt myself more and more gravitating towards just find something to agree on. And then we, in the end, we talked about something that actually we agreed on, and there was no confidence. It was impossible.
Hmm. It was all the confidence.
Yeah.
So you had dramatic effects from matching and mismatching the physiology.
Share the same kind of experience.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's hear from some of the others. Did you have a similar experience?
We had the similar thing. We started with the topic on the diet.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a disagreement. Mm-hmm. And then when we started matching the body, I agreed with him. I was more open to his ideas, to point of view. And I didn't even realize that I started with disagreement. I suddenly imagined. I said, oh, I don't have any
disagreement. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
It was more easy. Because we were not struggling to give in. It was mm-hmm. more natural transition into agreement.
Mm-hmm. So your experience was that matching the physiology really helped facilitate the agreement.
Yep.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What else? What else did you notice or experience?
Uh-huh. I was mismatching. And she started matching my mismatching. And we were agreeing real about it. And then it was making fun of me, started laughing.
Yeah.
And then the other one, we were talking about something we disagreed on, and we were matching, and she started agreeing with me.
Yeah.
Well, it was logical.
Yes.
You presented your argument well, apparently, yeah. So interesting, isn't it, that, you know, we've been exploring a lot about, you know, psychogeography and positioning and things like this. And one of the things that, one of the, like, really early pieces of NLP was noticing how when people are in rapport, in a state of rapport with each other, and they will tend to match each other physiologically, just naturally. If you observe, like, if you go to a restaurant and you observe people around that, oftentimes, you know, especially if you look at couples and things, and if they, you know, from your perspective, it looks like they're having a good time, oftentimes they'll take bites at the same time, they'll take drinks at the same time, they'll have similar matching of their physiology. Even in the youth corrections environment, it was kind of funny, kids of the same gang, you know, they would all be standing at, they'd be standing in the, at the, like at the side of the building or something like that, and they'd all have this posture, and they were all like lined up like dolls in the same posture, everything, but only the same gang. It was a different gang. It would not have that same match. So the idea of rapport is based on a perceived sense of commonality that you have with somebody. If you think, for example, when we meet somebody for the first time, what do we often do? Like, if you meet somebody for the first time, isn't there oftentimes some seeking of common ground? You know, like, you start asking questions, oh, where do you live, or where did you grow up, or what school did you go to? Oh, I went to that school too, or I studied that same topic, or maybe it's some, you hit on some point of interest that you have in common. And then the conversation starts to settle in around that commonality. Oftentimes people will talk about the weather, because it's certainly, if you're in the same physical location, you're experiencing the same weather, and it's an easy one to have in common, non-controversial usually. So we tend to seek that commonality. We tend to like people that we perceive as being like us in some way. And we can further make a generalization that the brain likes sameness. It likes congruence that way. And so we have a tendency, to like people that we perceive as being like us in some way. Now, even though the brain may like sameness, it learns from difference. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. The brain likes sameness but learns from difference. So this idea of rapport, and it's particularly in NLP, being in a state of rapport oftentimes will invite more receptivity, more openness, more a sense of kind of trust and mutual respect. We even have phrases in our society like birds of a feather, or we're on the same page, or we're singing the same song, or we might be playing different instruments but playing the same song. And when like couples get together, you'll often hear, oh my gosh, we have so much in common, you know? And it's like, oh, how awesome is that? Not often at times with couples, there needs to be enough sameness so that you have that sense of rapport, that sense of commonality that you can relate with each other well. But it's also nice if there's enough difference in there that you can learn and grow and expand each other a bit. And there's that just right kind of balance. Because if you have too much sameness, then you're in relationship with yourself, right? And if there's too much difference, then it's hard to relate with each other anymore. And that often too much disagreement. So in the land of NLP, we want to help invite that state of rapport in the person that we're working with. And there are many, many ways to do it. So one of the ways that we just experimented with a little bit is matching them or mirroring them physiologically. So what I mean by that are basically things like posture and gestures, is positioning. So if they're standing, you're standing. Wouldn't it be kind of weird to have, you know, a conversation, you're sitting and they're standing? That, for me, that would be really weird. I could do it for a short time, but after a while, I'm going to want to stand up or try invite them to sit with me. So their basic posture, how they're holding their body, gestures, for example. Some people are, you know, they have big gestures and they're, you know, it's oftentimes accompanied by big words or loud language, those kinds of things. And so they're very expressive. Other people, it's softer, it's quieter, there's smaller gestures. So being able to match the sort of the size and intensity of their gestures. Also, for example, if they're holding a particular position, you know, like if I were standing here talking like this, stroking my beard here, somebody might put their hand up close and maybe play with a button on the chest or something like that as a way of matching that kind of a gesture. The difference between mirroring and matching is mirroring is you want to give the mirror image back to them as if they were looking in a mirror. So for example, if we were having a conversation and so yeah, adopt some position. So she's crossing her right leg over her left. So in order for me to mirror it, I have to do my left over my right to give the mirror image back. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, matching, the difference between matching physiologically is that I would duplicate. And this is more useful if you're side by side with somebody. So if they raise their right hand, I would raise my right hand. I would duplicate their physiology as opposed to mirror their physiology. Does that make sense, the difference? It would just be more if they were in front of you, I would do more mirroring. If they're by the side of me, I would do more matching. Yeah, exactly. Well, I've been getting a lot of practice with that here at the hotel, going up and down with people in elevators. Now, the interesting thing with this is, again, this occurs naturally. Much of NLP, all NLP really has done is looked at what people do that's already effective, and then we do it intentionally. We do it consciously on purpose to produce that result consciously. Mirroring and matching occurs in relationship naturally all the time. When people are in rapport with each other, they naturally mirror and match each other. So with NLP, we just want to do it on purpose. We want to invite that rapport consciously and intentionally. So when you sit down to work with somebody, it's a useful thing to begin to mirror and match their mirror or match their physiology. Now, can you take this a little too far? What happens if you do it too much?
They get uncomfortable with you.
Right. It gets weird. They feel like they're being mimicked or mocked. So you don't want to take this to the degree where it crosses over to where it's it's like the Marx Brothers type of a thing, you know? And they might be going, what the heck are you doing? Or it might pop into their conscious awareness. You're matching my every move, or you're sitting the same way I do, kind of a thing. One of the things that makes NLP really effective is when, and Damon and I have been having conversations about this, that NLP ideally operates in the background of your awareness. That's when in my opinion, it gets super elegant, is that it's operating in the background of the awareness, that the NLP isn't in the foreground of your awareness. So when you're mirroring and matching elegantly, what the effect that you get, the special effect, is the person just feels relaxed with you. They feel open, receptive, they're in a state of rapport with you. That's the effect that you're going for. And so if you do it too much and it crosses over into conscious awareness, it actually can have the opposite effect. And that'll be true with many, many, many things in NLP. That if you do it too much, or your timing's off, or something like that, it crosses into conscious awareness, and now it seems weird, or it feels like they're being techniqued, or something like that. So it gets really elegant to get it so that it operates subtly. And that takes practice, lots and lots of practice. Did I see your hand?
They were starting to feel uncomfortable, and people would actually, I could tell they were wanting to leave. And finally, I thought, this stuff doesn't work. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to try something different. I'm just going to notice what people do. I'm going to notice their posture, I'm going to notice their movement, and just notice things. And so I started doing that, and suddenly I started to feel the rapport really building.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to understand, well, they feel my attention on them, and they feel my attention in ways that they probably don't normally feel that people putting attention on them in that way. So I was noticing finer little details. And then suddenly I looked down at myself and I was already mirroring them.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't realized it. And that was a huge lesson for me, because what I realized is when I was being a perfectionist, I was putting all the attention on me. So of course they didn't feel like they were seen.
True.
When I changed my perspective and put all the attention on them, well then the rapport started to build. And what this is really about is when you're mirroring and matching someone, you're actually exploring their world somatically. That's why this is so effective and powerful. It's about stepping into their world and seeing it from their perspective. And when you do that with people, the rapport has to build. There's no other way to do that. The rapport will grow and it will be very strong. The more you can step into their world, the stronger it will be.
Yeah, this is an extension of the walking in other people's shoes that we explored. You're going to get more of a sense of what's going on with them. I love the way you said that, exploring their world somatically. And that's definitely true.
When I first started learning it, those of you that are interested in hypnosis, I was watching Arnold McGill perform. Mm-hmm. Those of you know who he is, he's dead. Armin McGill, he's a famous hypnotist. Was famous even in the 60s all through, like, he was 85 when I saw him, like, 10 years ago. Anyway, he was such a master at rapport that there was a break, and then I felt, I was looking at him, and I felt myself going like this, and all of a sudden, I was like, I snapped out of it, and he was tilting his head. He was actually using pacing and leading as a transinduction,
mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, that is a really powerful technique. Even, I mean, well, especially for hypnosis, rapport is everything. And but then, so I was really inspired to practice. And what I found is what people would say to me every day was, "I just met you, but I don't know why I'm telling you this." And I would mm-hmm. hear that every day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's often the effect of rapport. Is that you'll get that kind of feedback? Say, you know, I don't know what it is, but you're just so easy to talk with. I feel like I could tell you anything. And that's kind of the effect that we want to have. Other resource people, you have interesting rapport examples from your experience?
Again, with walking in one's own shoes or in each other's shoes like that, when I know that I have proper rapport with the client, is when I stop and I turn towards them and they do the exact same thing, thinking that they actually finished what they actually wanted to say.
Yeah.
And I'm already at the point where we can start working now. And they feel like, okay, we can start working now. So if we stop, we turn, we start working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's actually at that point that I already feel like, okay, we can start working.
Yeah. That's actually one of the tests of rapport, is that if you match somebody for, and in my experience, it only takes a minute or two, even less in some cases, if you're doing it on multiple levels, but a minute or two, and then you shift some aspect of your physiology if they unconsciously shift to match you. So if I just shift my weight from one side to the other, they shift to match me, and it's like, okay, now we have unconscious rapport. Now I have permission to lead. I'll talk about pacing and leading here shortly. But so that's one of the tests. If you're in rapport and you shift some aspect of your physiology, they shift to match you. So it's amazing. This is the thing I love to do with youth corrections kids. One kid, he was acting out, going off, and so there was this wonderful woman that worked there. Her name was Judy. She was 70 years old. She was just about 4'8", you know, and she was really good in general, doing groups with the kids, but not so much one-on-one. She was like, she would pick, she's falling around, just telling them to correct their behaviors all the time. And it would annoy the kids, and that it would cross a certain threshold and the kids would be on the verge of violence. So then she would have us male counselors go take them to their room. So I happened to be in that living center that night, and I had some rapport with this kid anyway, but there's Judy, she's at his door, and she's looking in the window, and she's picking on him from the window, you know, telling him to sit down, to quiet himself, to quit swearing, and all of this stuff, and of course, that's adding fuel to the fire. And so I went and talked to her, and I said, what's going on? What's going on with him? And so I look in the door, and he's just red-faced, and I said, Judy, can I talk to him, please? And she's like, sure. So I say, Jason, can I come in there and talk to you? And he's like, no. Like, okay, this is going to be fun. So I go and, you know, I'm talking with him. Am I matching his volume level as he's yelling? So he's yelling, and I'm like, hey, what's going on in there? Why are you in there for? And then I start lowering my volume, and his starts coming down. And then when it got to a certain level, we were almost whispering through the door. Then I knew it was time to go in. So I go in, and he's sitting there, and actually he moved away from the door. He's been restrained many, many times, so he knows the drill. So he gets as far away from me as he can, and I come in, and I notice that he's got a picture on the wall of his cat. So I start misdirect his attention, and I start talking about the cat. And I'm telling him about my cat. My cat's name is Commander Riker. Okay, so we start talking about our cats and everything for a moment, and again I'm matching him physiologically and so on, and then I start turning and he starts turning, and then I sit down on the bed and he sits down next to me. I didn't have to tell him to do that. I didn't have to ask him to do that. I didn't have to threaten him with my keys to do that. I just sat down and he sat down next to me, and now it's like, Jason, why are you in your room again? Now we're having a conversation. Now we're getting to the good stuff. Okay. So I had to go through this process of pacing, mirroring and matching, pacing and leading to get him into a state of rapport, a state of receptivity. Now we can have a productive conversation about something because we have that state. That's what we're working on here, is to get to that kind of level. So posture, gestures, breathing is another really powerful way of pacing somebody, and it's often a very unconscious way of pacing somebody. And this is, so let's just try this for a moment, okay? Breathe together as a group. So I'm going to raise and lower my hand to indicate inhale and exhale. So let's just breathe together. But before we do, I'd like you just to take a scan of yourself and the room. Just notice what it feels like here in the room right now, okay? And then begin with an inhale and exhale. So what did you notice? Now, if you were to now just check yourself, check the room, what's different? Say again?
I got sleepy.
You got sleepy? What else?
I was able to do it all the way to the end. I had to change my breathing about than you were offering.
I was going slower than you were breathing? Okay. What else?
In fourth position, really easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sort of felt like I lost my skin. Like, this is sort of Damon references it as fourth position.
Did anybody else feel more, a little more connected to the rest? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It felt kind of like a breeze does.
Mm-hmm. Well, being in the front of the room, that would make sense. You know, you were getting more breath coming this way. No, but I get what you're saying. Yeah, it's like it shifts. My point in this is that it shifts your state. Shifts your state. And when you can breathe with somebody, breathe in. The way I did this with my kids, my son, who was, again, around 3 or 4 years old at the time, and I started experimenting with, I would observe his breathing when he was sleeping. And he was about 6 to 8 respirations per minute when he was asleep. And so I remembered that. And then when he was cranky and it was time for a nap, everything, I would say, hey, Brady, you want to watch Lion King with Dad? Sure. So we get on the couch, plop on Lion King, and then I'd hold him in my lap, and I would breathe at the same rate with him, okay? I breathe at the same rate, and then I start slowing mine down a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, pace down to 6 to 8 respirations per minute, and guess what happened? I went to sleep. It worked like a charm. No, actually, it did work with him. About 85% of the time, I could get him to go to sleep that way fairly quickly. Only about 2 minutes it would take. Now, when my daughter was born, okay, 6 months old, you know, doing the daddy-daughter thing, you know, we're cooing and gooing with each other, but she's cranky. She needs a nap, too. Have you ever tried to pace the breathing of an infant? It's not easy. It's not easy at all. So with her, I did eye blinks, okay? So we're engaged with each other and everything, and she'd blink and I'd blink. She'd blink and I'd blink. She'd blink and I'd blink. And I would blink her to sleep. Okay? So I'd breathe my son to sleep and blink my daughter to sleep.
Question,
okay?
Does yeah. it still work today?
Huh?
Does it still work? That's a good,
I'm going to try. When I get back, have my son come stay for the weekend. See? No.
When they were teenagers?
No, you know what's funny is my son is a clinical hypnotherapist now. So he's, you know, modeled all the behaviors and everything, and he's quite good. He's quite good. Unfortunately, and this is a little bit of personal note, I lost my daughter in a car accident about 1.5 years ago. And so that's something that it's the hardest thing I've ever had to face, and so I'm still dealing with that. So even as I'm telling the story of blinking her to sleep, I'm getting a little teary. So, but anyway, these skills are really amazing. You know, and again, there's so many contexts in which you can use them. Got a question over here?
Yeah, what's the difference between pacing and leading line?
Thank you. So pacing can be done, it's a big category. It's a big category of different behaviors that you can use to pace another person's experience of reality. So mirroring and matching physiology is one way of pacing. You can also pace language patterns. You can pace tone, tempo, and volume of voice. You can pace using predicates. There's lots of different ways of pacing, but think of it this way. It's like you're getting on the same side with them. It's like you enter into their reality. You join them in the way that they view the world and the way they're holding themselves and that kind of thing. And then you're together. And then you're together, you're facing this thing, whatever it is, whether it's a problem or a goal or something like that. You join in with them and then you lead them into what it is that they want. Lead them into a better reality in some way. So that's the way I like to think of pacing and leading, is you're joining with them, and you can pace in many, many different ways. Mirroring and matching are a subcategory of pacing. Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's a different kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But how are there any similarities in there, or is it the opposite of what you were talking about?
I think there are some. Right, yeah. There are some. The example, I also have a bird. I have a green sheet conure. His name's Zazu. And I'm not sure who's pacing and who's leading with the two of us, but we have these synchronized behaviors kind of a thing. And so, of course, you know, parrots, they do the mimicking of what you say. And he likes to say, "What you doing?" So he'll come fly up on my shoulder, "What you doing?" And it's funny because, I don't know if I'm hallucinating or not, but it's often very context appropriate. You know, like I shift my behavior and he'll fly over, "What are you doing?" So some animals maybe it is a synchronization of some kind. I think with dogs, there's another dynamic too, because they're pack oriented. So there's certain pack behaviors of like who's alpha and who's not and things like that. So certain behaviors with dogs are about establishing who's alpha, things like that. And that, from what I've seen, that's not pacing and leading. It's dominance. Right. And even in youth corrections, with kids with a predatory environment or predatory mentality, sometimes I would need to establish dominance with them in order for them to respect me enough to then they would be receptive. If the counselors were fearful or they were submissive, it evoked their predatory tendencies, kind of a thing. So there were several times where one fun, and this is a relevant example with what we're discussing here, one kid who was very resistant to authority figures in general, we call them polarity responders in NLP, somebody who just automatically takes the opposite position or the opposite response. And he would do this just habitually, automatically. If authority figure said anything to him, he'd want to argue with it, he'd want to fight it, resist it. So one day in after school group, we're sitting here talking, and he's doing his thing, you know. And I was getting exasperated with him, so I said, "Okay, all right, here we go." So I said, "Rick, I want you to listen to me." They all knew I was a hypnotist and a martial artist, and so they called me Obi-Wan Kenobi. And so I said, "Rick, I want you to listen very carefully to me. You know I'm a hypnotist, right?" And he says, "Yeah, so?" I said, "Well, that means I can make you do things." Now, what do you think that does to a kid with that kind of mindset? He's like, "You can't make me do shit." I said, "Oh, yeah, watch me." So I put something down on a piece of paper and handed it to the kid next to him. And I said, "Rick, I want you to listen very carefully to each and every word I say, because with each and every word I say, you're going to become stuck in your chair. And no matter how hard you try, you cannot stand up. You cannot stand up. You cannot stand up. No matter how hard you try, you cannot stand up." So what do you think he does? He popped out of that chair like Superman. And he was like, boom, see, dun-da-da, you can't make me do anything. So I have him, the kid hand him the paper, and it says, "You are now standing." So now I intentionally did that in front of his peers for the sole purpose of establishing dominance, because they teased him mercilessly for the whole rest of the day. And so now I let him stew in that for quite some time. And then I finally, later I pulled him aside and I said, "You know, the only reason I could do that, the only reason I could control you like that is because you're so dang predictable. I knew what you were going to do." I said, "What I invite you to do is to start making choices based on what serves you, not in terms of just automatically defying authority, because that makes you predictable, and that's how we can control you from this point forward." So I put him in a double bind, right? Now, that's kind of extreme. That's kind of an extreme example of what can be done. And by the way, I got that technique out of an NLP book. I think it's in Transformations or something like that. But the idea with this is that we want to be able to gain rapport with people by giving that impression of commonality, that we're more alike than different. Now, in order to do that, we need to have greater range in our behavior so that we can mirror and match not only their physiology, but tone, tempo, and volume of voice. So that's going to be our next experiment. What I'm going to invite you to do in a moment is to get into groups of three and decide who's an A, a B, and a C. You're going to have a conversation just to get to know each other better. So you're just going to talk to just to get to know each other better, just like if you were meeting somebody. Person A is just going to speak at your normal tone of voice. Person B is going to speak at half that rate. So given my current rate of speech, I would slow down to about half that rate. Does that make sense? Okay. A speaks normal rate, B goes at half the rate, C's going to go slightly faster than A's rate. So you speak a little bit faster so that you're just slightly above however fast they talk. You can tell that's harder for me too. Okay. So you're just going to have a conversation for about 2 minutes and then rotate so that each person gets to experience each of those rates. So when you rotate around, you'll each get to one, just speak at your normal rate, speak at half the rate, and then speak slightly faster than whoever the person is who's on deck. No, well, it's like a conversation. So not talking over each other at the same time, but yes. That sound good? All right. Now, yeah, so let's do that, and then we'll come back, and then we'll add a part B to it.